Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It is Thursday, which means it's time for the Front 3 Q&A podcast with me, Adam Bolt, with the one and only Dave O'Brien.
Boom, back again.
Boom. Lawrence McKenna is here as well.
Hey, how you doing?
As is the man himself, Chris Hennage.
I always want to rap like Marcus does. I don't know why. But
The Marcus intro is just, it's hard to beat.
It is hard to beat.
It is. Classic.
High standards to live up to. To be set. Guys, thank you so much for listening. We are going to be reviewing the Premier League action. We're also going to be talking all the latest transfer news, a lot of transfer bits and bobs going on. We're also going to be doing a little preview of the FA Cup this weekend, as well as taking your questions from Twitter. Before all that, though, we have to do hole of the week. Comment of the week, hole of the week this week is Who's Trev? Who wrote in on iTunes, left us a very nice review, and it simply says, "What a great podcast. Statman Dave, what a specimen. The world of stats will never be the same. Thanks, guys, for a fantastic podcast and for getting me to and from work." Who's Trev? Thank you very much, sir, for your review. Dave.
So many questions, so little time. Dave, are you driving this man to work?
He works at my house, actually. So I've rented out the kitchen during the day. I'm so skinny these days. So, it's me and Trevor Powell's.
It all makes sense. It all makes sense. Trev, thank you very much for your review.
So that's why he knew the specimen that you did was in the
specimen.
Fridge.
Specimen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
What a review. Deservedly hole of the week. If you want to be hole of the week, do you get your reviews in on iTunes. Leave us a little rating as well. Be very much appreciated. Right. Let's talk Premier League. Of course, last night, Tottenham Hotspur beat Chelsea 2-0 at White Hart Lane, ending their chances of a 14-game winning run that would have equaled the record. Of course, they have got the 13-game winning streak, which equals the record in a single season. But a fantastic win for Spurs, given the animosity between the two clubs now, obviously fantastic to end that record for Chelsea. It was a brilliant performance, has to be said. Chelsea, they weren't at their best. They were dangerous in the opening of the first half when Eden Hazard was clean through. Probably didn't realise how much time he had. Probably should have taken it down and maybe put it away in those first few minutes. They also looked dangerous to start the second half when they were pressing for the equaliser. But Spurs played at an extremely high level. I mean, Dele Alli, of course, took the headlines once again. That's a third brace in three consecutive games for him. But the plaudits also should go to Danny Rose, who was superb once again. Christian Eriksen, who frustrated a lot of Spurs fans at the first part of the season, but has really hit his stride now. Got himself two assists last night. Victor Wanyama dominated midfield. And of course, the team is instantly stronger for having Toby Alderweireld back in the defence. And it feels like the intensity is back once again for Spurs. But tactically, Dave, what did you make of the game? Because obviously Pochettino matched Chelsea's formation with three at the back, and they seemed to cancel each other out for most of the first half, but it ended up working pretty perfectly for Spurs.
Well, it was a simple move from Pochettino in essence of how to attack this Chelsea team. This Chelsea team is quite weak through the middle centrally. You know, you're thinking of the back three usually taken up by a single forward or two forwards, and it's those two central midfielders is how you can get at this Chelsea team, and that's exactly what Spurs did, and they just overloaded that zone with Victor Wanyama and then Moussa Dembele's energy and aggression and ability to carry the ball. You know, the amount of times that Kante was bouncing off him, it was getting a bit ridiculous. But if you look at both of the goals, they're pretty much exactly the same goal, and it's something that Spurs must have worked on in training. Yeah, Christian Eriksen picking up in the inside right channel, crossing to in between the right wing back and the right back. The right wing back and the right centre back for Chelsea. That same space two times, the same goal. But Dele Alli, you know what is his level of performance in recent weeks has been absolutely incredible. What, 6 goals in just 3 games, 3 braces in a row, like you said. What, he had never scored 2 braces in a row in his career. Now he's scored 3 braces in a row. But I think Christian Eriksen and Dele Alli, they've both been in really, really good form. In the last 3 games, Christian Eriksen's been directly involved in 23 shots on goal, which is pretty incredible for any player.
It is interesting that Eriksen's quality. You know, this formation also seems to bring the best out of Dele Alli, as you say. I mean, he doesn't necessarily put his stamp on a game in terms of build-up play or creativity, but, you know, he himself said he didn't influence the game in the way he'd want last night. But he is clinical in front of goal, especially with his head, as we've seen in the last few games. Perfect in the system, as I said, where he's almost like a second striker, Dave.
Yeah, it's kind of a second striker, but kind of not in a way. He's a bit deeper. He's more of a Frank Lampard than an Antoine Griezmann. I'd say Antoine Griezmann's probably second striker that is making that move from, you know, from more of a just behind the striker. Whereas I said, Dele Alli would be a little bit deeper. Although Christian Eriksen and Dele Alli did play off Harry Kane yesterday. It was quite an interesting system, the 3-4-2-1 that Pochettino was playing with. But Dele Alli, you know, incredible. Because his form at the start of the season was quite poor. You know, him and Eriksen were both really poor. And they finally, you know, kicking on this season, it's all coming together for them. And they were brilliant against Watford, fantastic against Chelsea. And I think it's, you know, it's going to keep going. I'd quite like to talk a little bit about the wing backs as well, because Danny Rose and Kyle Walker both played very, very well against Chelsea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we said this on the Monday podcast, how important they've come for the team. And as you said, it was an interesting matchup, the sort of the four in midfield. You've got Wanyama and Dembele obviously in the middle. But as you say, Kyle Walker and Danny Rose were just exceptional last night, weren't they?
Yeah, they're really good. I think it's, you know, you kind of look at systems that play wing backs and they do need to be, you know, the wing back is a weird role, let's say. It's very difficult to be a good wing back and a good fullback. Spurs have got two players that can do that, both, you know, Kyle Walker and Danny Rose. I think the battle was, the big battle was Danny Rose versus Victor Moses, who's played very well this season, but for me got a little bit exposed. Got exposed against Manchester City in a similar way, where they were exploiting his defensive fragility and his, sometimes his ball watching, both of the goals, you know, you could say he was ball watching. He potentially should have picked up Dele Alli. It was similar. There were a few times where City got in behind him with clip balls over the top. But I thought that Alonso did very well. It was just Victor Moses versus Rose where it really sort of Spurs had that advantage, because the battle between the other two was brilliant. Alonso versus Kyle Walker. It was a fantastic battle of fitness, of one of them getting forward, one of them defending. And I quite like to see that. And I do like back three formations. And I think it's something that, you know, the Premier League will start to do a lot more over the next few seasons. I think we'll have a, you know, a tactically very, very diverse league with the managers we've got.
Is it always back threes though, Dave? I mean, it's not. That's what I was almost finished a documentary on Pochettino, and there's been a lot of talk in that about the versatility of his formations and sort of how long that's been around, and sort of, you know, that's harking back to the 80s and you know, Argentinian football, those sort of things, but how the back three is really a back four, but Pochettino makes it so much more fluid.
I think that it's definitely a change in system. You know, Pochettino does play a certain style of football. You do play high octane, you do play in one half of the pitch wherever the ball is. When you've not got the ball, you know, you press very high, and I think you can apply that 20 formation. I think that's what Pochettino's done so well, is that he can switch between a four and a three and a five at times yesterday, and they still play the same aggressive football, and they still know their roles on the team. And that is credit to Pochettino in terms of him being, you know, speaking to the players obviously in training and identifying what they need to do, because it was a different system against Watford. It was a clear 3-5-2, and this was a clear 3-4-2-1. So that flexibility that Pochettino's showing, and, you know, the game before that, they played a 4-2-3-1. So they've played three systems in the last three games. They've won all of those three games, and they've played very, very, very well. And it's incredible. Pochettino, what a manager.
Hey, Adam. Do you think it's so much that, because someone was saying to me the other day, I can criticise Pochettino, he's not very versatile. Or he doesn't change things fast enough. And obviously that's been proven to be wrong this season. But it's almost as if people are misreading what Pochettino was trying to achieve. Why do you think there are times where it looks very clear? And why do you think there are times where it looks less clear? Because it's only now that I'm really looking at it and trying to analyse it that it seems a lot more clear. I've had it explained by a number of sort of professionals, those sort of things. But the interesting thing is that someone said the other day, it isn't even so much about the formation for Pochettino. It's about the, like you say, like the roles within that formation. So it's not so much the shape as the way that the players operate within the space.
Well, you know, you look at the Spurs play in the final third, it's all short tempo, high octane passing, a lot of runners, you know, from wide areas. The fullbacks do exactly the same thing as wingbacks. You know, when they're playing the 4-2-3-1, the three behind the striker get very narrow and the fullbacks overlap. They do that in every single system. They'll do that when they're playing three at the back, when they're playing, you know, 3-5-2, whether they're playing a 3-4-2-1 like they did last night. It's the same sort of roles for the players, but there's just like different numbers in there. That's why it's so fascinating. That's why it's so brilliant. You know, you look at the 4-2-3-1, they play it very narrow in the final third. You'll see Eriksen, Ali, and Son, if he's playing, or Lamella last season, all very, very narrow. You know, look, last night, instead of playing three attacking midfielders, they just played two. And that's, you know, and that ability to be so versatile and play the same sort of roles within the system. And I think it's what works so well is that last season, some of the best stuff was between Dele Alli and Christian Eriksen. And all they did last night was, instead of playing them with another player in attacking midfield, it was the two of them. And they combined the same way that they've always been combining. I think that's credit to Pochettino and how he's got these players playing. Because I think Spurs they're ranked ninth, I think, in terms of wages in the Premier League. And there's a direct correlation between wages and where you finish in the league. So Spurs and Pochettino are massively outperforming where they should be in the Premier League right now. And they have been doing that for a number of seasons now. So credit to Pochettino, Argentinian football at its finest.
Pochettino, he's magic, you know. As for Chelsea, as Dave said, they'll be disappointed to concede basically the same goal twice. Dele Alli, as Dave said, finding space between Azpilicueta and the right centre-back. Obviously outplayed on the night, but at the same time, as Gary Cahill was pointing out after the game, they have equaled the record for consecutive wins in a season. Obviously disappointing not to match the overall record. And they do still have a 5-point cushion at the top of the table. With that in mind, Lawrence, I mean, are you buying into the talk overnight that the tire race has been blown wide open now with six teams sort of competing for the title?
Well, I think six is a little far. But I never thought it was close. So I don't think it's been blown wide open.
Well, Robbie Savage was saying, let's hand the title to Chelsea now, you know, just get it over and done with.
Sure. I mean, well, Robbie Savage's league, I'm sure, would be an excellent one.
Ryan Giggs would be top.
Every time. Although I've heard Ryan Giggs also likes other positions. I never think it has been closed. We knew that at some point Chelsea were going to get, in inverted commas, found out. And it is so fascinating when teams... I do wonder how much being on the cusp of something affects a team mentally. So, you know, the 50-game streak that Arsenal got so close to, the record that Chelsea got close to. And they were so close to it, and they were playing so well in such good form. They did go in as the side that should have won it.
Yeah, I mean, it was... I saw some describe it as a shock victory. I'm not sure I quite agree with that. Spurs are undefeated at home this season. Oh. And I think part of it was how the level that Spurs played out. They were so up for it mentally, physically. They dominated the game in many respects for me. So I think it was difficult for Chelsea to match that for whatever reason. On the title race talk, Chris, where do you think Spurs factor in? Because obviously they responded well to the disappointment of crashing out of the Champions League in November. It's now 5 wins in a row. Where do they sit for you in this title race?
I think they're involved, and I say that because they've got a real versatility to them. They've played 8 different formations this season, and for all we can look at the Chelsea game, I think one of the key factors in them beating Chelsea was the fact that they had the full-backs, or in this case the wing-backs, to do it. I think that alone could be the difference maker for them, is that they've got a lot of players that can operate in central positions. You look at the likes of Eriksen, Ali, I would even say Son, Dembele, guys that really work best when they're in the centre of the field, can pop it around nice and short. If you can keep Rose and Walker fit and manage to give them the protection they need to go forward, then it just makes Spurs a lot more of a dangerous proposition. You've got to think as well, Lamella's still in there. I don't think that the best of Sissoko's come at this point. There is also that concern about what happens if Harry Kane falls away, because... And when I say fall away, I mean injured, really, because he's just the perfect fit for this team at the head of it. There's no one I could think of right now who would work better in that striker role, because he's a bit of a target man. He's arguably a complete forward in a lot of ways. He's a poacher. There's there is so much versatility, even just in Kane's game, that makes him a danger. And I think this team, as a sort of togetherness, as an entire entity, it's a brilliant team that has a lot of different options. And I think the only frailty I can see in that is that having so many options means you also have so many potential mistakes you can make.
Where the question comes in from Nicky James. He says, who is the most likely to win the league out of the outsiders? So second to sixth place he's specifically talking about. He's essentially saying which of those...
the outsiders being anyone but Chelsea.
But which of those teams essentially are most likely to challenge Chelsea for the title at this stage? Because it is shaping up nicely. Dave, what do you reckon?
Well, I've got to stick to my guns, haven't I? And I've got to say Jose Mourinho's Manchester United, because they're in some good form at the moment. I
think he's gone there.
The form side in the Premier League, and it's finally clicking. If they, you know, they can pick up a few more players in the window, I'd love to see a centre-back. Although Rojo and Jones have been fantastic, you know, they've been paired together. United have gone on to win, they've been undefeated in 13 games. They're looking good. If United can get a player that could, you know, even push that even further, put that to a higher level, that'd be pretty incredible. Or another elite forward or another midfield. You know, United have got money to spend, and they could spend it. Potentially Mourinho won't spend it, though, because it is looking good. You know, the depth of their squad is pretty awesome. You think of the wing positions, they've got five players that can play in those positions. You think of the centre-halves, there's three players at the moment with Eric Bailly off at the African Cup of Nations. Then you've got the two full-backs. There's quite a lot of depth in this United squad now. Maybe in central midfield, if the likes of Morgan Schneiderlin or Marouane Fellaini is let go in the window. I doubt Marouane Fellaini with Morgan Schneiderlin's looking like he's going to go. Maybe bring another central midfielder in there. That could be quite good. But United, they're only 5 points behind Liverpool in second. And they were at one point, I think they were like 12 points behind Liverpool or 12 points behind second position. So they're looking like they're they're pushing forward in the league.
What do you reckon, Lawrence? Who's going to push Chelsea closest?
Well, now Dave's advocated Manchester United. It's good to have some comedy back on the podcast. I'm going to go...
I've got to say, though, to be fair to Dave, as he points out, they're not... I mean, they're only 3 points behind City. I think at one stage they were 9 points behind, even more, potentially.
Obviously, I'm being trite. They're a formidable side right now. No, I think it's unfair that when someone makes a joke, they get called a troll, Adam.
That's what it is, Lawrence. If you make a joke, you're just a troll now.
That's a really good point. Literally.
Technically.
I could advocate for Liverpool. I could advocate that, you know, if they can get through January, which is basically without Sadio Mane, and they can also ride through some of the lack of squad depth that they currently have, maybe recruit one or two more up front, and maybe look at replacing a centre-back in Saka, then I do think they've got a good squad. But the problem is they don't actually have incredible depth within the team right now for all the investment that they've made. And Jurgen Klopp is actually doing quite well to get these performances out of the side. In the sense that he's, you know, if you look at the bench, he's hardly got a full bench right now. But that's not really an excuse. You know, they should have the quality from front to back. I still think Liverpool will be up in the top four come the end of the season. I think they'll definitely run first and second very close.
I'm gonna part of me doesn't want to say Spurs because you know
you could they but could always... is the problem that they will the same as Liverpool and the same with Chelsea, which maybe where Dave's Manchester United contribution comes good, is that Jose Mourinho is one of the managers that doesn't run his team into the ground. And Conte, Klopp, and Pochettino are all sort of notorious for running their teams into the ground.
Yeah, I think, you know, we saw that in the previous two seasons that Spurs did, their level did drop towards the end of the campaign. I'd expect the same again this season, especially as we're seeing the pattern where, you know, we're performing so well at Christmas once again. I think for Spurs, though, to be on the form we're on is very encouraging. And looking at the fixtures, they're relatively kind up until sort of late April when, you know, we've got to play Arsenal, the likes of Man United, the likes of West Ham all in a row. We have got to play Man City later this month on the 21st of January, which could obviously be a key fixture. But I'm feeling pretty confident, especially last night, you know, when there was a lot of pressure on Spurs and I think there was a lot of expectation on them to potentially avenge earlier results and earlier defeats to Chelsea in recent times, and also make a statement of their own in terms of title race. I think you know, the confidence and the momentum is with Spurs. Everything seems to be firing on all cylinders. Apart from Spurs, it's difficult to say. I wonder if, you know, Man City seems to be in a sort of difficult patch, as it were, at the moment. Arsenal, of course, have got their own issues. Yeah, I wonder if it'll be Spurs and Liverpool that push Chelsea closest. I mean, Chris, who do you reckon's out of those outsiders, as it were, as it's put by...
China.
Yeah, which one is going to potentially challenge Chelsea?
I don't think Man United's a bad shout. The problem I've got with the teams above them, Arsenal, City, Tottenham, is how their sort of mental sides hold up, because I think City have got... a bit of a habit of collapsing this season when things don't go their way. Tottenham showed last year that when they needed to really hold their temper, they couldn't do it. And they did absolutely lose it at Chelsea. So you're kind of guessing on whether they've improved from that last season, and whether that summer that Pochettino talked about was actually a transformative one. In terms of Liverpool, I flip between yes and no, purely because there are moments where they look so rampant in attack, and yet there are also times where I could see them being nullified by a well-organized team. I think more often than previous seasons, or more importantly than previous seasons, excuse me, how they fare against each other will likely decide this one. I think a lot of the time you can look at how the teams pick up points on the road. I think Leicester had the best away record last season, as an example. This year, I think it'll come down to who can take points off each other.
As for Arsenal, one of the outsiders, apparently. Incredible comeback from them. They're 3-0 down against Bournemouth. Managed to come back to 3-3. A 70th minute goal, sparking their comeback. But of course, Chris, all the discussion is about how much credit do we give Arsenal for fighting back from 3 goals down. First time they've ever done that in the Premier League, with 20 minutes left. And how much criticism to give them for being in that situation in the first place?
It's really tempting to do an impression of a YouTube celebrity there. I think, honestly, you can't really give them much credit for fighting back, because, again, it's still a point that they've gained at the end of the day. The ease with which they were broken down in the first half was frightening if I'm an Arsenal fan. Bellerin, in particular, had an absolute nightmare of a game against Ryan Fraser, who, funnily enough, I thought at the time, oh, that's a good move from Eddie Howe, because it will theoretically nullify Bellerin in the final third. It'll give him someone that can keep up with him in terms of sprinting, whereas actually the problems were all on Bellerin's end in the defensive third. It was nothing to do with stopping him in the attack. So, no, I think it was a really poor performance from Arsenal. This is the problem, and this is something that I've wrote about this season, is I don't think they've got enough character in the ranks. I know we always want to try and break things down and talk about the tactical side of things. I think there's a genuine character issue there in terms of players who can really stand up when the wind is blowing against them a bit. But I also think there's an issue with pressure. I think that team is far too it doesn't engage with its opponent enough. If you the first half, when Nathan Aki, he runs through the middle of the field from defence, that to me is criminal. I don't know how he's managed to do that, because he hasn't gone on some massive slalom run. He's walked into space pretty much. And I think that's the problem, is that we talk about different types of pressure and how people engage in the high press and how important that is and how on trend that is. I don't think Arsenal have any kind of press, really. They just seem to sit back and expect the opponent to make a mistake. And it's that kind of complacency that I think far too often costs them when an opponent performs higher than expected.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, Chris mentions certain YouTube celebrities, as it were, there. I mean, Arsenal fans weren't happy, Lawrence, with their record against top six teams this season and in previous seasons having been so poor. They do need to secure the points if they are going to challenge for the title against the rest of the league. And obviously with Chelsea losing a day later, this result does feel even more disappointing, and you are getting that familiar Groundhog Day feeling once again.
I also think with Arsenal, though, what's funny is they are similar to Spurs in that sense. I think people do misanalyze Wenger quite a lot. I think they misanalyze some of the ways that he plays sometimes. They're much less reliant on ball. In fact, they're almost not reliant on ball retention at all. Arsenal and the way that they do play now has changed a lot from back in the day, even maybe a decade ago, obviously. But I think a lot of people still sort of apply those same models to Arsenal. I mean, we also need to credit Eddie Howe on this one, surely.
One thing on talking about Arsenal and their style over the last decade, there's something that I'll put on our Twitter page that Opta did this week, where they looked at Benitez, Wenger, and the third man, Pulis, over the last 10 years, and they looked at some sort of key metrics for them. And one of them was things like how many passes did the opposition produce before a defensive action is performed by each team. And you'd be surprised how little Arsenal have actually changed. I think part of the reason is a drop in quality in players. I don't think they're shopping at that top tier of the market like they used to. But yeah, they really haven't changed a drastic amount in the last decade since they, well, it's over a decade now, but since they last won a Premier League title.
On Bournemouth, Lawrence, I mean, you're talking about giving Eddie Howe credit. Obviously, he was massively disappointed after the game that they couldn't beat Arsenal for their first time ever, considering their 3 goals up. Obviously, Dave, the red card had an impact, but Eddie Howe made a number of substitutions. Like, for example, he took off Fraser, that some Bournemouth fans felt had invited pressure on to them, that it made the team sit deeper. Obviously, they were under concerted pressure from Arsenal, who managed to come back in the end. What do you make of that decision, or is there any criticism that you can give Eddie Howe for making those substitutions and changing the game in that way?
I think you've got to look with a 3-goal lead, or you know, your opponent's coming back into the game, you've got to change something, you know, change your shape, go to a back five, just try and see the game out. You know, they had a massive chance, didn't they, when Bournemouth were 3-0 up as well, Bournemouth to take the game to 4-0 and just, you know, going wide. So I think
that was crucial, because it was Gosling who was through. And he sort of made space for himself, a nice little Cruyff turn, just sort of didn't get the angle of his shot right, didn't get the angle of his body right. And moments after that, obviously, the red card came, which obviously turned the game on his head. So, yeah, a defining moment in many ways.
Yeah, it's difficult. You've got, you know, if the momentum had swung and the momentum had changed with the red card. So it's difficult to change that in football. It's difficult to change that in sport. You think of any sport, when the momentum swings, it's very, very hard, especially organising yourself with 10 men when they're coming back, and you know, the runners that Arsenal have got from midfield, the movement they've got. And yeah, I think it's a decent result still for Bournemouth. Getting a point at home to Arsenal is still a very, very good point. So, you know, Bournemouth fans shouldn't be too disheartened, but obviously Eddie Howe could have changed it, could have changed something else. With you know, when they still had the man on the pitch.
On the same point in context, you have to say, you do have to appreciate almost how far Bournemouth have come. On the day of the game, on that day in 2009, Eddie Howe was taking caretaker charge of the club in his first match at Bournemouth. They were second from bottom in League Two, so obviously 91st out of the 92 Football League clubs, you know, and here they are. It's just an incredible journey for them.
Let's not pretend that they didn't spend the money. They spent a shitload of money. In League One, in League Two, they absolutely blasted the competition out, because they spent the most money. In the Championship, they were very, very competitive with money. Weren't their record signing that South African striker that pretty much like played like 4 or 5 games and then was chucked off somewhere else? But yeah, it's a good story, and it's good that young managers get the chance. You know, Gary Rowett, the Birmingham manager that got sacked, and now Gianfranco Zola's in. When Rowett was, you know, his last game, they were 7th in the league. They're now, you got sacked, now Zola's in there, and then 13th. I do like that clubs are supporting young managers. We've got to remember that Bournemouth have spent a bit of cash.
To be fair, Ranti only cost £2.5 million. Even in the Championship, that's not a lot.
Yeah, but that was back in the day when that was quite a bit in the Championship. That was before we were seeing Ross McCormack flying around for £20 million or whatever.
It's only 2-3 years. It's really not that much in the Championship. It's like a decent fee for a team. I wouldn't say it's the exorbitant way that you're paying it personally.
It is then,
the bigger one was getting out of League Two and League One. That's where they absolutely blew the competition out of the water with money.
It is, yeah, I think it's, I agree with David that it is a great story, but of course, it's weird that not much is made of how the club's been bankrolled, essentially. But yeah, it's still a remarkable ascent, I think it's fair to say. On the red card, Lawrence, obviously, as we're saying, changed the game, renewed calls of video technology after this game, and obviously the Man United-West Ham game where Mike Dean had his influence. Francis obviously saw red, and he's actually going to serve a three-match ban after losing the appeal. What do you make of this chat again, Lawrence? Because there's actually some movement behind it now. The Premier League are reportedly exploring the possibility of additional video support for match officials. They've got former referees involved in weekly trials aimed at kind of testing a system that could be introduced in time for the 2018-19 season, should it be improved by the International Football Association Board. Thing is, though, Lawrence, what are we going to talk about down the pub if this does come in, you know?
Very good, Adam. Very good indeed. We'll talk about how the new referees still make mistakes, because robots are still going to make mistakes, and there's still always going to be rules which are subject to interpretation. So I think, though, it is referees for some reason this season seem to be getting a lot of the spotlight. You know, whether it be with China or with, you know, making too many motions whilst out on the pitch. Some people like the spectacle. I think it's fine, as long as a referee maybe doesn't buy into it. But that's part of the problem, is that also you need to be quite a personality. And not everyone wants to be a referee. Just appreciate the personalities. And as long as it isn't really having a massive impact on the way that the game is being refereed, then it's fine, right?
It's, yeah, I think, you know, we were talking about the whole Zlatan controversy earlier in the week, and I just think it's so difficult to be a referee with the speed of the game, with how many decisions come along and how difficult they are to judge in the moment. I think they do need help, essentially. Matt Browniegate asked on Twitter, why do you think the standard of refs has been in decline in recent seasons? Hashtag goal line tech is amazeballs. Has the standard of refereeing been in decline, do you think, Chris?
I think the game's got faster, which hasn't helped. I think the general speed of things has made it harder for referees. I do think in some regards it's a generational thing in terms of the quality, in the same way that we talk about good generations of players. I think the same applies to referees. And yeah, overall, I've said for a number of years now that I think really the general quality of referees has dropped. I think honestly what doesn't help is, and this is just my opinion personally, I think referees have become a lot more media savvy in all the worst ways. You look at the likes of Graham Paul,
Did you see the story about Mike Dean? A story that appeared on The Guardian. It said Mark Clattenburg says he would consider a move to the Chinese Super League. And you're kind of like, should we be seeing articles like that?
If that kind of thing, it's so far removed from the likes of David Ellery and people like that in years gone by. I mean, you know, Kalina had a fairly big media presence. He was also an exceptional referee at the same time. That's the problem. Whereas really you look at people like I say, Howard Webb, Mark Clattenburg, they seem to fancy themselves a little bit, for want of a better term.
I mean, but to be fair, Henry Winter was making the point that Mark Clattenburg is quite well respected within the refereeing fraternity.
True, but then I think the best referees are the ones you don't really remember in that regard, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. Kalina's the difference.
Yeah, Kalina has such an iconic image. That's kind of the problem with him in that sense. Whereas, like I said, David Ellery, he's not someone that jumps to mind when you think of referees, because he was very good, and, you know, he was someone that really did kind of observe the game and influence it. He didn't seem to make himself such a prominent figure. And I think, you know, you look at Mike Dean, and we can laugh and we can scoff at it all we want about the way he goes on. There are definitely moments where even I think you're kind of looking at this as if, like, it's your moment. And I just think the second that we start to see stories like that about Clattenburg entertaining a move, it's jumped the shark, so to speak, because, again, referees aren't ever supposed to be centre stage. They're just not. Because didn't Clattenburg sign a contract with some agency recently or last year?
I think he had to tear it up almost immediately.
It's things like that. You know, it's that idea of, again, you could argue the warning signs were there when people like Jeff Winter were doing after dinner speeches and all this kind of thing. It's like the game is definitely not about you guys. Sorry. If that's why you got into it, then I hate to disappoint you, but it's definitely not about you guys.
I think it definitely includes them.
It does, but if you want to talk about refereeing issues, there's that young 17-year-old lad in Manchester who's just put forth a campaign to stop abuse for Sunday League referees. Yeah. I didn't see any of the prominent refs getting behind that campaign, but apparently Mark Clattenburg's got time to talk about moving to China. It's that duality for me that's key here, because they should be focusing on things to do with the actual profession and making it better. And too often it just doesn't seem the case. When you hear referees going on, you know, Jimmy Bullard podcasts and things like this, it just doesn't make sense to me. I don't think it's their place, personally.
Let's move on.
Even ex-refs?
Ex-refs to a degree, I think, yeah. The problem is that the obvious question is, well, what do you think of refs now? And for the most part, it seems like there's a lot of politicking involved in that. So a few are quite happy to throw their, you know, their former colleagues under the bus. And I think that in itself is a little bit disingenuous to the cause. I think it's all about, you know, I think you say something along these lines, so apologies if I'm not quoting you correctly. The medium is the message in that regard. And I think if you're using someone like Helena to evaluate referees in a very intelligent and critical way, then that's very much fine by me. If it's kind of salacious stuff and it's all very vacuous ways in which I'm seeing it at the minute, then I don't think it has a benefit personally. I think it's stroking egos at that point.
I think sometimes we try and transfer some of this stuff from the online world to the real world, and vice versa. We try and transfer some stuff from the refereeing world. Referees are the most serious side of football, essentially, because they get there to enforce rules or at least remind us of them. And then when you try and sort of put it in social media, or you have them going on a wacky show, or you know have them trying to make sound bites, then of course you're going to come out sometimes with stuff which isn't properly thought through. And I think sometimes we sort of feel as if referees and all these people are being presented with no lens to it. And actually, I think there is a massive lens over the referee as well. And just because the referee is such a straight-laced sort of serious figure, a lot of people just sort of think that therefore that's the only way that they'll be represented. There's no way you could bastardize the way that they are represented. And, you know, it's not as if ex-refs have got their own agenda or have their own ideas about the way that the game should be refereed or their own politics to play. And I think sometimes that can get sort of lost, especially in a refereeing conversation, like I say, where it's a more serious sort of subject matter or lens.
Let's move on to Crystal Palace 1, Swansea 2. Massive win, obviously, for the Swans, Chris. Paul Clement, officially supposed to be watching this game from the stands, having been appointed early in the day. made his way down to the dugout for the second half, though. Managed to get his influence and his stamp on the game. Quite a new manager bounce there. You know, we spoke on Monday about the difficulty of taking that job, how it's a risky one to sort of take on. Do you think there were signs of encouragement, though, for Paul Clement in terms of avoiding relegation for Swansea?
There were. There were also, I saw, real fine margins involved, because there's a decision for a penalty that goes Swansea's way. And it's things like that where you stop and say, okay, they've got the victory, but we're going to take such a superficial reading away from this in 2-3 days' time, when realistically there wasn't a huge swathe of improvement. And in fairness, like I say, Clement hasn't had, I don't think, a training session, hasn't had games with them at all. But already we're looking at, oh, look at the new manager bounce. There's so many ways to easily paint this as being Clement's influence. I really do think that it'll take until February until we see what kind of influence he's realistically had. Because at this point, a lot of a good feeling or a good reason straight with Swansea at home, because there were some key decisions in their way. And if they get that penalty, I think it's a red card as well to Fabianski. So it changes the dynamic of the game massively. But overall, yeah, I think you should never be too disappointed at picking up points, regardless of the way that it works. The key thing for Swansea and Clement right now, and this is the thing, I don't know how much time he's had to prepare it because he's been working at a different club, so I imagine he hasn't been thinking about it, is what players can they get in? Because they need, I would say, four, maybe even five players if they want to make a really good fist of trying to stay up. Because they might pick up a victory here and there, but to actually build some consistency, I think they're going to need one, maybe two centre-backs, maybe a pair of midfielders, and a forward with a bit of pace. Not a winger type like Barrow or Routledge, an actual centre-forward who's got a little bit of pace about him, something to stretch teams, and someone who can actually just mix it up from Llorente. Because Llorente is a very static forward, and it's great if you can get Sigurdsson and that, like throwing balls in for him. But teams will just push up. They'll just keep a little bit of a higher line. And I think there's a little bit of need for versatility in that final third with Swansea.
What about Palace then? Obviously, Sam Allardyce about a win in his first three games now. That wouldn't have been how he wanted to kick off his tenure at the club at home. And now, of course, the team's main man in many ways, Wilfried Zaha, is obviously off to the African Cup of Nations, which is obviously a big blow. Do you think this could be the time he finally goes down in the Premier League, takes a team down to the Championship, Chris?
I don't think so, and I base that on two things. His start at Sunderland wasn't very good either. It was actually quite poor, and the important contrast there is that Sunderland squad is a lot worse than the current Crystal Palace squad. And so really, if you'd probably given him a few less games, you could argue that Sunderland would have gone down last year. I think the key difference, as I said there, is the quality in this Palace squad. It takes a little bit of time, I think, for Allardyce's methods, as simple as we might think they are, to really kind of sink in with the players and forge something. But once he gets that discipline and organisation, which is kind of the foundation of everything he does, then things start to look much better. And because he's got those players with quality, the likes of Zaha, the likes of Townsend, that's when things can start to change, along with a real massive aerial presence, which is Christian Benteke. I'm curious how he handles Zaha personally. I mean, we look at someone like JJ Kocha and say, you know, he did such wonderful things with him, it should be fine. If Zaha's not willing to be industrious and work hard going the other way, I could see a little bit of a coming together there with the two of them. But overall, yeah, I think even the likes of Kabay, and you can list off the players that Palace have got that are quality, I wouldn't be worried about them going down at this point. I think they do just have a lot of important attacking components in there. And that's the thing. Allardyce can build a defence seemingly with anyone, as he showed last year with Sunderland. He can get clean sheets out of almost any kind of defence. It's how he does at the other end, and he's got fantastic players in that sense.
Hasn't quite got the best out of Benteke yet, but you'd expect him to do so as time goes on. As we were saying, obviously Paul Clement, the main man at Swansea now, but Bob Bradley's still in the news, Lawrence. Why is that?
Well, I mean, he's got, rightly so. And I think it is unusual to keep a manager in the news for so long, and so maybe it's worth sort of paying some attention. I think some people in the media feel he's been hard done by Swansea. We sort of alluded to it on the podcast. There's a few rumours going around in the media tumble dryer, if you like, that not everyone was colluding in the same direction at Swansea, and that a few people don't seem to have favoured Bob. You know, I think for that reason he's been given a voice, because I think some people do feel he's been hard done by. I also think there's a bit of kind of pro A, English speaking, B, American bias, and C, the fact that Bob is actually quite good at engaging the media himself and has some people who are around him. Like, obviously, we've sort of experienced that firsthand ourselves, that if Bob sees criticism or sees something that he doesn't necessarily think is right, then not more often than not, but at times he's going to want to step out and correct it. So it's as simple as the fact that Bob maybe feels like he's been hard done by at Swansea and wants to set the record straight, essentially.
So what was the actual report?
Bob Bradley to the Norwegian national team.
You what?
Bob's been linked to the Norwegian national team.
Oh, has he now?
He also said, which I thought was quite funny, obviously obviously there was a story that came out and people said that his players were calling him Ronald Reagan, and Pomp said, and paraphrasing,
this is a great one,
I can assure you not one of those players knows who Ronald Reagan is.
Wow.
Which is
cutting. That's
true,
is
but
cutting.
Very cutting. But yeah, he has been linked to the Norwegian national team. He's still really highly thought of in Norway. In fact, the sporting director, whose name is escaping me, at Starbuck, was pitching him for the national team long, sort of not even 10 minutes after he'd been let go by Swansea. So he was spotted in Oslo, said he was visiting friends, which I don't believe for a second. And the talk is he has an offer on the table. I can exclusively reveal on the front three.
Whoa.
That our friend of the show has an offer from Norway that he can take if he wants.
There you have it, guys. Yeah, interesting one, Matt. Yeah, very interesting one. Friend of the show, Bob Bradley. So we wish him all the best for the future. Let's finish up the review of the Premier League with Stoke winning 2-0 at the Britannia Stadium, ending a 5-game winless run in the Premier League to move above the visitors. Watford also playing 3-4-3. Apparently everyone's doing it now. Apparently gets the best out of Peter Crouch, who of course scored once again. He's apparently been offered a new contract, or is going to be offered a new contract at Stoke at the age of 35, which, as you say, just makes sense. One win in 8 for Watford, though, not quite getting dragged into the relegation battle. And there are certainly 3 worse teams than them in the league. So you'd expect them to stay up, but still worrying form for them. Could all be to blame, though, Lawrence, on witchcraft.
Are you talking about the story involving strong suspicion that Isaac's success and his injury problems are down to a witch's curse?
It's everywhere. Witchcraft is everywhere in the game. Got to open
Adam,
your eyes.
I like that you're a believer, first of all. I like that you've taken it on board. His people are beginning to think that it is some people who are not happy with his progress who are chasing him with evil witches. I'm led to believe by an African news source, an African website, I'm told.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
They are suspecting juju against the boy, which I think is kind of magic. The thing would be that, I mean, you know, obviously there are a few different approaches to this. One would be sort of a psychological one. I just wonder what, like, when it sort of gets to this point, that it all gets very fluffy and hazy, doesn't it? Like, what?
That's probably the, like, witchcraft.
But what would you do, though, if someone came to you and said, oh, sorry, you know, there's a spell?
I've put a curse on you.
Or, yeah, no, just sort of like, oh, sorry, can't come to work today. Why? Having trouble with a witch. Maybe it's a cultural thing. And I don't mean that from a sort of xenophobic point of view. I mean that from just a sort of like a, you know, I mean, it's slightly a misinterpretation of culture kind of thing. And I wonder how many people in the media are more than willing to kind of eat it up, us included. It is funny.
It's interesting, I think. Unusual. But
wasn't there a rapper who used to put curses on teams as well in the States?
I think he still does, isn't it? Lil B. Is it
something
Lil B?
Like that?
And he basically curses basketball players.
Yeah,
that's just bizarre.
And genuinely, I think basketball players buy into that.
From success to failure, Mike Phelan also this week, sacked after 3 months in charge. Only one win in his last 9 games, so Hull have decided to make a change. He can't help but feel though, Chris, it feels a harsh decision in that many of the problems that are facing the club are not of Phelan's making.
No, they're not. They're not at all, and most of them we've outlined before, so I'll not go into them in too much detail, other than they lack quality and numbers. I think the man they've appointed in his place is an interesting choice. He's kind of billed as the mini Mourinho sorts. I read quite a good profile by Jack Pitbrook, and then a similar sort of information piece by Tom Cundit, who's a really knowledgeable Portuguese football specialist. So I think if I'm a Hull fan, I'm a little bit optimistic as to what the new man can bring, because he seems to have something about him. The mini Mourinho, as he's kind of been dubbed by some. But I think, again, you could almost apply it to that same thing with Swansea. Is they need numbers in January. They need to make signings. And the other difficulty comes, and I've spoken to teams about this, and recruitment staff specifically, it's such a harder sell in January when you're struggling, because you've got to put either relegation clauses in there, or you've got to give them assurances that if things go pear-shaped, they can get out. And it just really does complicate deals in a lot of different ways. So it's a big ask, not just for the coach, I think for all of them. They've shown flickers of quality, but again, I don't think it's any other problem than they just lack it across the park. There's key positions, centre-back being one, that they don't have enough quality in or enough experience.
Let's look ahead to the FA Cup then briefly before we get into part two. First up, perhaps one of the most eye-catching fixtures of the weekend is Manchester United against Reading, Chris, which sees a return of Yap Stam to Old Trafford. You wrote an article about this for Yahoo today.
I did. Mr. Yap. Had his Man United career ended in a petrol station by Sir Alex Ferguson, who told him he was leaving.
Wow, unceremonious.
Yeah, it's one of the few things that Sir Alex has admitted was a mistake in his career, that he should never have sold Stan, which is an interesting one. But yeah, when he was tired, it was kind of a left field appointment. It's almost a nice transition from Hull to this, because he didn't have any managerial experience in that sense. He'd assisted at Young Ajax and his first club's Voller as well. But he was hired by the club's director of football, who, again, knew him at Ajax, but is kind of orchestrating a little bit of brilliance down at Reading, because they haven't got a lot of money to spend. There's a lot of uncertainty off the field with the ownership group and all this. But they've managed to get the likes of John Swift in, Roy Behrens is another one, and they've blended together a fairly young squad. I think it's the joint second youngest in the Championship right now. And they play some really nice possession football. It wasn't all that way, as the piece goes into a little bit greater detail. At first, it was kind of awkward and there was a transition period. But now they are a very fun side to watch, actually. And they do catch eyes very easily, because, like I said, there's not a lot of teams that play the way that they do. They've got the most possession of the Championship, highest, I think, pass completion rate, or second highest. They really are up there in that sense. And again, Stam is he's exactly how you'd expect him to be, in the sense that he's very stern, but he's also very sure on his ideology. Now, that could be something that trips him up in the future, where he lacks the flexibility that we talked about with Pochettino and the ability to be versatile. But overall, I've been quite impressed with what I've seen so far. I'm eager to see how the next 4 or 5 months pan out, because if they can stay where they are now in third, or even unseat one of Brighton or Newcastle in the last few weeks and go up, then it could be massive for not just him, but I think Reading as well.
We'll come on to the Championship in a second. Before that, elsewhere this weekend, Tottenham are playing Aston Villa. Obviously, with the form they're on, you'd expect Spurs to win that one. Hopefully, a chance to see some squad players, the likes of Vincent Janssen, maybe Moussa Sissoko starting as well. It would be good to see them get a chance. Preston are playing Arsenal. Obviously, Arsenal will be hoping to avoid a slip up there. West Ham United are playing Man City. That's a tasty one. Dave, who's your money on for that one?
Oh, Man City, definitely. West Ham United have not been great in recent weeks. They've been struggling to find form and fitness. Mikel Antonio playing up front against Manchester United. So I think they're still looking for a striker, obviously, Jermaine Defoe link. But yeah, I think Man City have got that one. But it depends whether Pep rotates his team like he did in the League Cup. Because if he does that, West Ham could nick something. I think it's all on Pep Guardiola's team selection. If he fancies it, City will dominate. If he doesn't, then the Hammers could be making it to the next round.
Could be another awkward post-match interview for Pep there. Birmingham.
Great, we can read it.
Playing Newcastle United. How are you feeling about this one, Chris?
Not sure.
Why?
Because the FA Cup, I want to believe. That's what it is. I want to believe that there's...
You want to believe in the magic, like, in the witchcraft of the FA Cup, but...
It sounds a lot more sinister when you say the witchcraft of the FA Cup.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Same thing, though, isn't it, right?
Say again?
The witchcraft is magic.
No, Adam.
Is it dark magic?
I imagine these are all FAQs on David Copperfield's website.
Yeah, sure. I'll head over there, don't worry. You carry on.
No, I want to believe that there's still the ability to shock. Does anyone else have any strong opinions on this one?
Well, what, the Newcastle Birmingham City game?
Safe to say, no.
It's safe to say that Rafa has got history in the competition, obviously. It's also safe to say that Birmingham City themselves have got history in the competition. So this is the problem.
Newcastle haven't won in that competition for, I want to say, 6 years now, possibly longer. So that's what I'm saying. When I want to believe in the magic of it and that it can still exist and, you know, have something to play for after January.
Are you trying to build Newcastle as the underdogs here?
A little bit, because they've got a shocking record in this competition. They really have. It's really terrible.
The thing is, they are away from home, so that...
that normally helps. But there's no Shelby. That's the other problem.
Can you give us a little update on the Championship, Chris? Because John Gibbons writes in on Twitter, can you chat a bit about Championship? Not heard you talk about it much on a show. Perfecto. What do you call that emoji? What's that like? Okay emoji he's gone for?
Oh, like the closed hand thing, yeah.
Yeah, that thing.
I prefer your description personally.
Yeah. I think it's officially Perfecto. I think it's the cheeky Nando's emoji, I think. Yeah, Chris, give us a little update on the Championship.
So at the bottom, you've got Rotherham, Wigan. No massive surprise there. Wigan play some nice stuff from time to time, but they can't put the ball in the net. At the midpoint, you've got Villa slowly climbing, kind of stumbling every now and again. They're a decent enough side under Steve Bruce. I just think that, again, they wasted a lot of money in the summer. They didn't really know what they wanted to do. They bought the likes of Tish Bowler, who doesn't really seem to play much, even though he looks, I would say, one of the better midfielders they've got, better than Westwood at least, because he's actually got some legs on him. Norwich are in a fairly similar position. Alex Neil's quite a negative manager from what I've been able to see of him. And again, he was another one that bought players like Pritchard and Canos, who were fairly young and exciting and vibrant. And Canos hasn't played at all, from what I can see. At least I haven't seen him in the first team in a league game. And there's talk about him actually going to Brentford on loan, which is mad, because I would have thought someone like Pritchard and Canos either side, again, perfect. They also struggle with the fact that really Cameron Jerome is not as clinical as he should be. He missed a hatful of chances against Brentford the other day. Brentford are in about mid-table. Again, decent, sort of, I would say, on the wane, on their hipster curve, if you will. Like, a few years ago, it was great to follow Brentford. And for all that Scott Hogan puts the ball in the net, there's not a huge... Actually, no, I'm not going to blame the players on this one. I'm going to blame the manager. I really don't rate Brentford's manager, Dean Smith. I think he's really simple in the way that he puts that team together, and I think they need a bit more complexity. The surprise package right now are Leeds, because they just keep winning and winning and winning. They are a very well put together team. They're very English, very industrious. Pontus Janssen looks a really good... Is it Pontus Janssen? I'm going to say Janssen because his first name is escaping me. But is at the heart of the defence, he's perfect. Really made for England in general. And I think they've just bought him actually from Torino. Huddersfield, their sort of Yorkshire rivals, are staying in there. They haven't really been as prominent in the discussion, but they're in fourth, so you can't really complain. They're a nice mix, I think, of Klopp-like ethos that Wagner's taken from their time together at Dortmund, with just little tweaks. They're maybe not as quick and fluid on the counter-attack, which you could expect because it's a drop in quality, But I think with Aaron Moy in the middle, they've got someone that really pulls the strings, which I don't think really Liverpool have, in my opinion. They don't have someone that's got real range. Because to me, and it's not just because he's bald as well, Aaron Moy is essentially a poor man's Jonjo Shelvey. And I mean that as a big compliment. Reading, we've already covered. Newcastle are just this bizarre team that either win or lose at the minute. There is no draws for them. They've only drawn one this season. And there are some instances where you think the refereeing is poor, the officiating could be better. They've had a few decisions not go their way. They did get quite lucky against Forest, saying that just before the year finished, with that red card for Matt Mills. Honestly, they miss Shelvey massively. That's what I've noticed the last few games, is when he's suspended, they've got no one who can really open up the field for them. And without that, you're looking at Colback and Hayden to pass it side to side. And then at the top, it's Brighton under Chris Hughton, who, again, I find it quite difficult to kind of isolate their style and say this is how they play. Anthony Knockaert has performed far beyond any expectation that I had for him. I mean, he came in last year, and it was like a January signing, so it's always a little bit difficult to gauge. But this year, he's absolutely hit the ground running. And, you know, it was quite sad he lost his dad fairly recently. And it hasn't seemed to sort of unsettle him at all. If anything, it seems to have just focused him into this frighteningly good forward. And then you've got Glenn Murray, who's got a lot of experience in this division. And their defence is, again, it's not pretty, but it gets the job done. And I'd be surprised if there's a change at the top two, personally. I think, realistically, actually looking at the table as it stands now, you might get Derby or maybe Derby, Norwich or Fulham taking one of those last spots that Chef Wed inhabit right now. But for the most part, I expect the top five to stay where it is.
Exactly.
Championship done. Let's move on to part two, where we're talking transfers and answering your questions. Transfers. Big transfer news this week is all kicking off at the start of January. First up, Dave, today, Southampton captain Jose Font has apparently handed in a transfer request. The director of football for Southampton, Les Reed, said he's made it very clear he would like to explore the opportunities for a transfer. That's where we're at the moment. Jose wants to leave the club. He's formally asked for a transfer. A bit of a bombshell, considering the rumours going around about Virgil van Dijk as well, interest from Chelsea and Manchester City there. Can you see Font leaving Southampton in January, Dave? His contract, as it stands at the moment, does run out in 2018, so they're not technically under any pressure to sell him in this window.
I think that it's probably time to go. I was listening to, I think it was Matt Letizier on, I think it was on Sky Sports, and he was saying that he was a bit of a bad egg, you know, come back from the Euros, and he thinks he's better than everyone else. And yeah, that's what they were saying there. It's quite interesting. It's obviously not cool anyway, for him to do that. But obviously, it's time to move on, and Southampton better get rid of him ASAP. Again, we spoke of the weekend where he made that a bit of a stinker of a mistake for the second goal. So yeah, maybe it's time for Southampton to cash in, and their scouting and their recruitment is so good, they'll just find another Virgil van Dijk and they'll be laughing.
So cashing on Font.
To be fair, I think he wanted a little bit more of a longer term deal. That was the problem, is that I think he wanted a little bit of... It's that awkward position where he's reached an age where really you can't justify giving him a long term deal.
Les Reed said that he was offered contracts. Maybe they weren't to the length or to the standard that he wanted, but apparently Les Reed tried to set the record straight today and say that, you know, Font has turned down a number of offers. He wants to leave. Interesting to see if he does indeed go and to manage to keep hold of Van Dijk. As for the other news this week, Jermaine Defoe dominating the headlines, Chris. Mackem Talk writing in, do you think Jermaine Defoe will go to West Ham? The Hammers have reportedly a £6 million bid for Defoe rejected earlier this week. They're apparently willing to bid up to £15 million for Defoe, but Sunderland will continue to reject any offers. Defoe is one of the few assets you'd potentially say Sunderland do have that could bring in money, could raise funds to improve the squad in January.
Well, but sell him for 30 and then you buy Martial for 20.
What about in reality, Chris, in the real world? What does Sunderland do in this situation?
Not Paul Merson's world. Come on, Paul Merson makes a little word too.
I really enjoyed watching that clip, by the way.
Yeah, it's a really good clip.
I thought it was from a parallel universe.
I thought it was from another bizarre world. But
it's literally like a man who is discovering football.
Everything about his reaction said he'd sat up the night before drawing that out.
Oh, God.
Yeah, he thought he was a genius.
Yeah.
In our very real world, though, Chris, can someone afford to sell Defoe? Really?
No, they can't. Definitely can't. And they won't. I could see him going in the summer, definitely. Because, again, he's at an age where he's probably planning his last 3-4 years. Because he's never really been about sort of speed or pace, I don't think, in at least in recent years. He's been about finishing and positioning and that kind of stuff. So he's probably got 3-4 years in him. I'd imagine he wants to go home at this point. He's kind of been to Toronto. He's been in Sunderland a few years. He's bounced around a little bit. West Ham, from what I can gather, feels as close to home for him as possible. So I imagine in the summer he might push for it. I don't think he would do it now. I think he has a lot of respect for Sunderland as a club. And yeah. I think he would be happy to see out the year, see what happens.
It's interesting in that I don't think it would be... From what I've heard from West Ham fans, it wouldn't be a massively popular... Because of the way he tried to leave the club all those years ago, the way he agitated for a transfer, him coming back would not potentially be as well received as you might imagine.
I can see that.
West Ham fans are never happy.
Honestly, though, the whole Defoe thing, the Dembele thing, it opens up to a wider point that West Ham's recruitment strategy is utterly bizarre to me.
To put
a £6 million bid in for Jermaine Defoe, who has a fantastic record, and someone on Twitter or Facebook said to me, you know, even as a Newcastle fan, you'll acknowledge he's a good striker. He's a brilliant striker, to be fair, and it pains me to say that because he's scored a fair few against us in derbies already. He's worth at least triple, quadruple £6 million. And then they put £20 million in for Dembele. And this is the thing that really kind of tipped it for me, because Dembele was available in the summer for about, I think, £1 million it would have been, something like that. Maybe a little bit more in terms of compensation fee. He was playing less than 20 miles away from Upton Park at Fulham. And yet somehow West Ham didn't manage to get down to watch him enough or didn't identify him and try and make that move. I just find it so maddening that, and again, the summer they bring Zaza in, they bring Kaleri in. Zaza, who is not a line-leading striker at all. He's someone that likes to sit a bit deeper. And then Kaleri, who, again, isn't that number nine for me. To then go from that to these January bids, it's amateur. That's the best way I can put it. It's amateur level recruitment in my eyes. And it's going to cost that club so much. And you look at even the likes of Gökhan Tor in the summer, there's a lot of players that West Ham have bought lately that just don't seem to make sense and don't seem to have any kind of concurrence in the way or the profile of players that are signed.
Does seem that Defoe will stay at Sunderland for now then. Will Morgan Schneiderlin stay at Manchester United though, Dave? Everton are set to make an improved bid after a £19 million bid was rejected. That's according to The Guardian. Do you think he's still got something to offer at Old Trafford, Dave, or is it time for him to move on?
Time for him to move on, 100%. I don't think he's up to the level of Manchester United. He's not up to the level for a team to win the Premier League, and unfortunately, if United want to go that way, they've got to sell some of the deadwood that's still there in a way, and Morgan Schneiderlin's one. I like United are playing hardball with the cash. Obviously, they've spent money in the last 2 years or so. It's quite good that then they are saying, oh, 20 million or nothing, or 25 million or nothing.
89 million.
So, yeah, hopefully we'll get 89 million, and then we can sign Koke.
Brilliant. Have you been speaking to Paul Merson? Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is another name in the headlines. Apparently,
he's famous.
There's been an insane bid of £128 million from Shanghai, from the Chinese league, Lawrence. Borussia Dortmund CEO Hans-Joachim Watzke coming out, though, declining to discuss the prospect of Aubameyang moving, saying the offer is hypothetical at the moment. I assume that means there's not an actual bid on the table, just that this is something that's sort of being discussed tangentially almost.
I mean, surely all bids are hypothetical. You literally go to the other person and you say,
you drive up with a lorry of money, of cash.
Okay,
dump it on the doorstep, yes or no. If not,
but even then, that's the point, is even then you say, hypothetically, if I was to give you this money, would you hypothetically give me that player?
Is it is it so insane, 128 million for Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, when we're seeing some of the other fees being slashed, about 70 million for someone like Carlos Tevez, who's coming towards the end of his career, for example?
Well, it's not insane if you put it within... Well, actually, it is insane because that scale's insane. But yes.
It's a completely different scale.
It would be ridiculous. There are so many different scales to measure it on, but it's almost ridiculous because if they were to take that in January, part of the problem would then be that they are main strikerless for the rest of the season. And no matter if they got 128 million or whatever, you're probably not going to be able to tempt many other top European sides with less than that. I mean, a lot of those sides will probably say, we know the fee you've just received, so pay us through the nose for whoever else you want, you know, whether that be Griezmann or Olivier Giroud or, you know, anyone else out there. At the same time, he's also one of the most sought-after strikers in Europe. And I also just sort of think that there's a reason they're paying all this money. Do they not know about what... do they not know what a mark is?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the best place to start your...
Where have they plucked that from? Do they just pull a finger out their arse and go, yeah, go on.
Bam.
It sounds like Chinese football clubs don't respond well to silence during negotiations.
Yeah, there's an air of panic.
That's what I think.
I'm sorry. We were literally we were just thinking about your offer. 200 million.
$50 million. Yeah.
300 million. No, you really don't get this negotiation thing, do you? Yeah.
Definitely interesting.
Sorry, we're used to negotiating with Trump.
Definitely an interesting one. All purely hypothetical at the moment, apparently. Another one that is purely hypothetical, coming from famed Twitter transfer source, Gianluca De Marzio. As it says on his website, questo sito contribuisce al audience de Sky Sports. So I think he's on Sky Sports in Italy. He is a man very renowned, in certain spheres for his transfer news. He's come out with an exclusive today, Dave. Conte and Llorente could be reunited at Chelsea. The report is that Batshuayi could possibly go on loan to West Ham or Crystal Palace in the window, and they could bring in Fernando Llorente. Now,
that's a good one.
An interesting one, but surely once again, it's not going to happen simply because Swansea can't afford to lose someone like Llorente, who could potentially be their primary goal scorer this season.
Yeah, I think it'd be a strange one. He obviously played under Conte before, but I don't think he didn't have that much game time. He was never the focal point of that side after leaving Athletic Bilbao with such a fantastic record and a fantastic number of goals that he scored there. You know, he only scored something like, you know, just above 20 goals for Juve over that time. So it'd be a strange move in. It seems like he's finally fitting in at Swansea. And, you know, with new manager coming in, it's probably be clever for Swansea to keep him and look to build around him with, with Sigurdsson in behind or something like that. So, yeah, I don't really see that coming off at all.
Do you think it would be a similar mistake to the one that they made a few years ago, building around Michu, and then Michu sort of left or got injured? We're talking about a lot of strikers here who could have made a big step up if they'd been offered a big deal. You know, Llorente could have gone. I mean, he did make a big deal to Juve, and Liverpool. Mm. You know, I always thought how good he would have been under a manager like Rafa Benitez, especially with so many Spaniards surrounding him. And then, you know, the same with Jermaine Defoe. Jermaine Defoe never made that jump.
He was at Spurs, mate, for a number of years.
Made that jump to a significant club.
Right, let's move on, guys. The transfers are done. We need to get into the questions. So many questions this week on Twitter. Thanks so much for sending them in. Let's start with King Mick at Du Beche. Who can Manchester United buy as a long-term replacement for the aging Michael Carrick, Dave?
I think there's a number of replacements. Victor Wanyama. Take
no chance, mate. No chance.
That'll be good. Maybe pop over to Monaco and sign Fabinho. He's been playing more of a ball-playing central midfielder this season, a bit more mobile than Carrick, a different player in terms of he's going to go win a tackle rather than make an interception. Or, you know, Koke, who I mentioned before. There's loads of players that could potentially step up. But I would quite like to see Victor Wanyama with under Mourinho, because that'd be, you know, power in that midfield. Paul Pogba,
real world, Dave.
Victor Wanyama, and then Antoine Griezmann ahead of that. That's just like filth.
You're in Paul Merson's head, is all I'll say. let's move on to the next question. Morten Christiansen He says, how much is Christian Eriksen worth? And how long do you think he will stay at Spurs? Interesting question. I was talking to YouTube, name drop it. I was talking to Spencer FC himself earlier. And he was he was running in the same circles. You know,
what's he like in real life?
Yeah, great guy. Wonderful guy. But
what's he really like?
He was interestingly saying that he reckons potentially the Spurs squad is one of the most valuable in the Premier League. And this comes from West Ham fans, so you know it's legit. You look at the likes of Christian Eriksen. How much is Christian Eriksen worth? Maybe 40 million in today's market?
Do you two just sit there in your little office going, West Ham are great, aren't they? Yeah, Spurs are great, aren't they?
Well.
Yeah, but I love Spurs. No, I love West Ham. Oh, you're great. Yeah, I love your channel too.
Do you not think that, Lawrence? You look at squad.
All right, mate. Tug, tug, tug.
Let's just focus on the question, guys. I really regret that shameless name drop now. Regardless of that, Tottenham. How much is Christian Eriksen worth? 40 million? You know, you look at Dele Alli. Is he worth 50 million, 60 million today? Is Harry Kane worth that sort of money? If you look at the bare value of the squad, it is quite something. But Christian Eriksen, how much do you reckon he would go for? 40 million? Something
like? If I offered you 26, what would you say?
Come back with another 20 million on top.
Because transfermarket.co.uk values him at 26.35, the highest in his career to date. He's been on a fairly upwards trajectory.
I believe Spurs bought him for 12 million, I want to say.
11.48 according to Spurs, but I'm more inclined to believe
that. Insane Gareth Bale, post Gareth Bale splurge.
Yeah.
One of the few purchases that was actually turned out to be a decent signing. I think that was
almost 4 years ago now, so you've got to factor in that. Yeah. So yeah, I think 4 years.
He just signed a new contract as well, so I don't think he's going to leave anytime soon. I think, a lot of the young key players will be staying for a significant amount of time. I think that Christian Eriksen's going anywhere. And even if you were trying to prize him away, you're talking 40 million at least, I think, at this stage. Do you think it's fair?
Do you not think it is one of the most valuable squads in the league?
He wants to.
Well, the thing is, you probably do think that you could. Essentially, those players are all biddable. Do you know what I mean? Because Spurs don't, like Dave was saying earlier, Spurs don't pay the highest wages. No. And also, though, Daniel Levy is somewhat of a tough negotiator.
Of course. But we've got that perfect mix of talent.
A mixture.
Players who have signed new long-term contracts and very young players. I think they are very valuable in all those respects. You know, someone like Danny Rose, who was derided by Spurs on just a few years ago, now is the best left-back in Europe. What else can you say? How much is that worth?
Well, mate,
how much is that worth?
As an Austrian international that is, have an argument with you about that.
I did hesitate before I said it, but I thought, what? I'm just going to go for it. On current form, right now, in Paul Merson's head, Danny Rose is the best left back in the world. Let's move on.
I genuinely didn't think that Spencer allowed drug taking at work, but.
No.
Okay.
I would say Rose is up there, to be fair. I can't think of a better two-way fullback.
Thank you. Kyle Walker as well, best right back in the world.
I disagree with Walker. You were on a roll until you mentioned Walker. I'm not going to lie.
I went too far.
Rose is fantastic.
Sandini writes in at Santia Gomazza. What are Adam's girlfriend's thoughts on Zlatan's current form? Good question.
Why don't you ask her, mate?
Let's ask her.
I'm very worried.
Wow, there you have it. Showing up. Thank you very much. Sandini also asks, was Mahrez a fluke or is he actually quality, Chris?
It's a very black and white question, that. I wouldn't say he's a fluke. I would say, yes, he is a talented player. One of the benefits he had last year is he was playing in a side that gave a lot of space to the attackers because it tended to transition really quickly when teams were overstretched. That helped him. I also think that to some degree, his habits from a dribbling perspective have become a little bit telegraphed. People kind of know what he wants to do theoretically when he gets the ball. So I would say it's not really a sophomore slump per se because he's in his third season now, I think, but that's probably the best way to characterize it. It's a little bit of a sophomore slump as the teams around him adjust to kind of playing against him.
John Gibbons writes in once again, says, Dave, if Evra is available in Jan, a few rumors floating about, would you take him back or just leave the left back position as is with Darmian/Blind/Shaw?
Obviously, bringing Patrice Evra back would be great for Manchester United in whatever,
really?
You know, as a player, as a coach, as a just general going around the training ground and having a bit of a laugh, bringing up the morale for the boys. But I think in a tactical sense, the reason why, you know, the reason why David Moyes could have let him go was his legs were going in a way that he used to attack so well, but he started to not be able to get back into his position, and that obviously is an issue. In the Premier League, that transitions quite quickly. At the moment, with Michael Carrick at defensive midfield, potentially that'd still be an issue. If United were to have someone a little bit more mobile at defensive midfield, maybe even Daley Blind to cover in that cover at left back, that could work out quite nicely. Or even you know, to drop between the centre backs and then Rojo to go out there. I just think that's a slight issue. Is Patrice Evra to cover ground these days? But he's still an absolutely fantastic footballer. He showed at Juve that he. Tactically and you know, his head is still very much in the game, so I'd love to see Patrice Evra return to Old Trafford. 100%.
Wonderful Instagram account as well. At Dayson1996, who has tragically changed his username from Gary Goals to what I assume is his real name, Yelbol Karimov.
Yelbol Yoles.
He says, do Liverpool really, all caps, need Joe Hart? I think that's for you, Lawrence.
Really, no, because I think the reason they get Joe Hart is to upgrade on a goalkeeper. I don't think he'd be such a vast upgrade on either of those goalkeepers in a sense. And I think if they probably were to get a little deeper into the market and didn't maybe paint themselves as being so desperate, then they might be able to find some more value. But to have a good English goalkeeper may be of a benefit at some point. So do they really need him? No. Could they take him and probably do well with him? We'll see.
Alexis Golitsyn, long-time listener, long-time friend. He says, with a lack of game time at Bayern, where should Thomas Müller go? Which club would suit him? Dave, what do you reckon?
Manchester United, just because I want to see Thomas Müller at Manchester United one time in my life.
It's hard not to love Thomas Müller. So I'll accept it on
this occasion. He should play anywhere. Could play Barca, could play at Real, could play at any team in Europe, could play at Juventus. He's one of those players that has that X factor and that is very, very difficult to pick up when you're not at the game to see his movement off the ball. You know, another player that's quite interesting as well, Renato Sanchez hasn't really played. Potentially, would he be in there, you know, on the move?
Interesting. Another one for you, Dave. Abdul says, have you got a YouTube channel or Apple podcast channel, bruh? Obviously, Statman Dave. Dave talks on YouTube, and obviously this very podcast. Need to DM that guy, Dave, and get him to listen.
I'll send him some DMs. Although Dave was on another podcast earlier about Football Manager. So if you like Football Manager, Dave, where can people hear it?
The Deep Lying podcast. It will be out tomorrow, I do believe, where we go into my Football Manager career this season, which is quite interesting.
Lovely.
Could also be a really good theoretical podcast about telling very deep lies.
Alex James says, will Man City finish in the top four? Yes.
Why did you ask that question in Welsh?
I'm not sure. It just came over me. My Tom Jones impression just came back to me.
You bet, buddy.
Ray Burkhue said, do you think that Sevilla are the league as Southampton in terms of main players and managers leaving, but still staying near the top? What do you reckon, Lawrence McKenna?
You know what? I think most people probably compare quite poorly to Southampton in that sense. I think they've done very well for a number of years because of the system they employ and because in many ways they have not matched up directly what Southampton are doing, but definitely managed to make a similar system work, although I'm not sure that they were the originators of it. I think another few clubs have tried to make it sustainable. The problem is Sevilla don't seem to be able to break the next level, if you like. Not for long enough anyway. And that seems to be the problem with most sides who try and break up the duopoly that exists in that league.
At Kevin CFC says, which MLS team has had the best off-season so far? Chris?
there's not been a massive amount of business done, really. My mind jumps to Atlanta United just because they've got Almiron, the Paraguayan, Kenwyn Jones, which might sound a bizarre one. But in general, the squad they've built seems quite an exciting one. Other than that, I mean, Real Salt Lake have just signed Albert Rusnak, who mean a lot to Man City fans. But yeah, there's really not been that many landmark deals. I was discussing that with someone today, the idea that the league's maybe transitioning away from older type veterans on big money. So yeah, it's probably come back to me next month and I'll have a better answer on that one.
What's going to happen with the combine in the next few weeks, Chris? They've got the Adidas combine?
Yes, this is where all the college players come and try and strut their stuff and all that stuff. The number one pick last year was Jack Harrison, a lovely young lad from Stoke-on-Trent, who actually did really well. He was injured for the first part of the season, but then came in and did fantastic stuff. Former United, Man United Academy kid, actually. So, yeah, there's a few guys to come out from that. That should be fairly interesting. It's a difficult one to predict unless you're watching the college game regularly, and there are some really good people. Travis Clark, Charles Bohm, J.R. Elkerson, who is a real person, I promise. They all watch the collegiate game with regularity, and we'll tell you who the best players are. Mm-hmm. For me personally, I tend to just pick up the combine and then, you know, base it off what I like the look of there, which is maybe a tad harsh.
Final question this week, that's all we have time for, is from the main man, Varun Joshi. He said,
"My man,
what movie are you most looking forward to in 2017? A non-football question, but I like it.
Wait a minute. I've got
some. Obviously, Varun Joshi, you're looking at Star Wars Episode 8. Come on.
The Wembley Cup of Sin, starring Adam Baldwin.
Yes. not technically a movie, but yeah, that's one to look forward to.
Yeah, so shut up.
You've got... You've got Blade Runner 2049.
Beauty and the Beast.
The trailer, not so much. Looks like a carbon copy of the original. I don't like that.
No, because if it was a carbon copy, it would be an animation.
It looks like a non-carbon, but yet extremely similar. It
looks like a graphite copy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lead copy.
What about Power Rangers?
No, it looks terrible.
Triple X, Return of Xander Cage.
Looks worse. We're talking
Baby Driver.
Oh. We're talking Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. You know.
Oh yeah, I watched that over Christmas. The first one.
It's so good, isn't it? It's so good.
The little raccoon's very cute.
Oh, just brilliant. And
King Arthur.
Nope, looks worse.
War for the Planet of the Apes looks quite good.
Oh yeah, that looks decent. Spider-Man.
Saw Legacy.
Spider-Man as well. I never thought I'd say I'm excited to see another Spider-Man movie because there's been a lot, but the new one looks very good.
The Emoji Movie.
Oh, painful. It's a thing. Mind you,
there's also
the only thing I'll say about the Emoji Movie is when they said they're making a Lego movie, you know, I said, what are you on about, lads? But that was fantastic, the Lego movie. Brilliant.
Trainspotting 2.
Oh, Trainspotting 2.
I saw the trailer for that the other day.
Dave, have you got any movies you're particularly intrigued about?
I'd love to get the DVD for the 2016-17 Manchester United season so I can rewatch Mourinho winning his first league title.
Dave, are you saying that's going to be the epic of 2017?
Ooh.
I think it'd be pretty decent.
They are the underdogs, you know, so it's an underdog
Dave, who's
story.
The lead man?
It's going to be Jose Mourinho, isn't it? Probably played by someone like Brad Pitt.
A man that no Perfect one believed role. In. A man who, you know, many thought were finished. And here he is lifting the title.
Would it not be someone more like a Robert De Niro type character sort of thing?
Wait, who would play Jose Mourinho in a movie of his life?
Oh,
Denzel Washington.
He's got the
character. As Mourinho's might.
Denzel Washington as Paul Pogba.
Who would play Jose Mourinho?
Surely it would be someone with the dashing looks. It would be Ryan Reynolds. I'd love to see Ryan Reynolds
as Jose Mourinho.
I'd love to see who's the guy.
What about Bryan Cranston?
Adam Sandler.
No. What about Bryan Cranston? One of the finest actors working today. He could bring the intensity.
Oh God!
The anger.
As Mike Phelan leaving before the season.
Yeah.
McFeely becomes he starts to cook meth in Hull.
Dwayne Johnson as Phil Jones with that little tuft of hair.
Brad Pitt.
George Clooney.
Oh, George Clooney would be a good one. Mm.
I think Bryan Cranston is a good shout, actually.
Tom Cruise?
Guys, tweet us at the front three. Who should play Jose Mourinho in a movie of his life? Hashtag Mourinho movie.
You can cast three people in the film. Who do you cast?
In certain roles. Jorge Mendes as well. You need someone to play that. He'd be like a kind of a Machiavellian character behind the scenes, like pulling the strings. All that could be interesting.
I guarantee you that Steve Bruce watches Gladiator and thinks of himself as the lead role.
See, when you said Steve Bruce, Ricky Tomlinson jumped into my head.
I'm Stevius Decimus Meridius Brucius.
I think there's a whole lot of chat here, but before we get too
father
far
of a shit defender. Before...
Very good.
Who plays? Surely it's Brock Lesnar who plays. Who's the guy who managed Leicester before Ranieri?
Nigel Pearson.
Finney
Jones.
Brock Lesnar
is playing him, isn't
it? Nigel Pearson.
Apparently, in this rumored long just saying Jamie Vardy movie, Finney Jones is playing Nigel Pearson.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah, just so you know. I can see Jason Statham doing it as well.
It distorted there on Skype for a second. I thought you said Mini Driver.
Did I?
Which really would be.
Bruce Willis is trending on Twitter. Maybe he's in the running to play
Phelan.
Same radio. Mike Phelan. No, Jason Statham for Mike Phelan, I think. Anyway, guys, tweet us on Twitter. That's how Twitter works. At the front three.
Thanks for that. Right.
That's how it works.
Just
saying
words at this point.
It's been a long podcast. We've been talking for a long time. I'm mentally.
Maybe Steve Carell
fatigued.
As like. No. I don't know.
George Mendes.
Yeah. Oh God, that'd be great.
Or
he's a
name
serious
the,
actor nowadays.
The bad guy in Ocean's 11, the one who owns the
Andy
casino.
Andy Garcia. Oh yeah.
That's a great
Mendes. That is a perfect show.
Excellent.
Guys,
Ombre could play Conte.
Thank you so much for listening to the front three. Hope you enjoyed this Q&A podcast. Until Monday, when we'll be back reviewing the FA Cup action. Lawrence, where can the good people, where can the whole find you?
I'm not very active online at the moment.
You've got a brand new video out, though, that people go and check out to see more of your face.
I guess you could go /football, see our latest series, or you can head over to our sister channel, Statman Dave, where he does plenty of stats ponder weekend.
On Statman Dave, you can get lost in stats and tactics. On /football, you can get lost in football. You see? Very nice.
Good.
Dave.
I got lost in the edit.
Dave, where can the good people find you?
I don't know. Maybe at my house. Come round for a cup of tea.
Cheeky cup of
seen
tea.
Seen it on the vlog, so just try and find it in London and I'll make you a cup of tea.
Ooh,
if you find my house, I'll make you a cup of tea.
That's a challenge. Dangerous game there from Dave. Chris, where can people find you?
Currently on Adobe Premiere, frantically bashing buttons and realising why nothing works. And Twitter as well, at KHENEHE.
Stop messaging me.
Stuff.
Right. Oh, mate, I'm the worst for that. Sorry. How do you add something?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You can find me on Twitter at Adam Butwood. Do come and follow me there and check out the Front for YouTube channel as well. Until Monday, have a great weekend.